Issues, Etc. is listener-supported. We rely on you for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Now, if you appreciate Issues, Etc., please consider making a tax-deductible gift today. You can make a secure online contribution at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Issues, Etc., and send it to Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
Was he a careless villain? Was he a hapless fool? We have Pontius Pilate appearing not only in the text of the New Testament as Jesus' judge in his final trial, but also in the church's creed. He was crucified under Pontius Pilate. But what does that make, and what does history make, of this man, Pontius Pilate? Was he the fool? Was he the patsy? Was he a bad man up to no good? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Monday, Thursday, April the 5th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Joining us in this hour to discuss Pontius Pilate is Dr. Paul Meyer. He's professor emeritus of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo and author of several books, including Pontius Pilate, a biographical novel. Dr. Meyer, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be back with you, Todd.
There's the obvious New Testament material that we'll get to here shortly, but where else in history outside the New Testament do we find Pontius Pilate?
Well, I was happily surprised to find that he shows up not only in the New Testament, but also in the Jewish rabbinical writings and also in Flavius Josephus, of course, but also in Roman records. And when I started my fun quest for material that's outside the Bible, it may or may not confirm material inside the Bible, and by the way, it does confirm it. I found Pontius Pilate an amazingly good bridge to use because he's Rome's man in Judea. And so in Josephus, for example, we have three very important episodes in his life that aren't in the Bible. Philo of Alexandria also gives us another important episode which sets the stage for Good Friday. And so we know a lot more about this governor whose this fateful decision changed history, no question about it. And therefore, I was kind of eager to see if the outside evidence would comport rather well or not with Pilate's conduct on Good Friday. And it just beautifully supports it.
How does he come across in, I guess we could call it secular history of the ancient world?
Well, the secular history of the ancient world is not too much interested in any truth there. It's a case of, here's Rome's governor in Judea. And of course, the general Christian impression also is he's very cruel. And what I found out was in our sermons and our commentaries, Pilate comes off far worse than he does in the New Testament. In the New Testament, he's almost acting like Jesus' lawyer for the defense. He tries every trick at his disposal, any method he can use to unload this case. He tries the quashing it for lack of evidence several times in the trial. He knows it's a religious matter, not a political matter. He knows Jesus is not a true insurrectionary. He tries the change of venue. Let's get rid of this case, send it over to Herod Antipas's court. He tries that Passover amnesty thing, Jesus or Barabbas, washes his hands. You know, from beginning to end, he's trying to do the right thing. And then he's finally compelled, and we know why.
Why is that? What compels him finally, in the end, to, I guess we could say, maybe even act against his own conscience and allow Jesus to be condemned?
Okay, it was a long-running problem he had with his Jewish subjects. And, of course, any Roman governor is going to have a problem with his Jewish subjects because it's actually blasphemous. It's actually a terrible attack on the Jewish religion to have a non-Jew in charge. Deuteronomy says, "You shall not place over you one who is not your brother." So all Gentiles, obviously, are not brothers of the Jews, and therefore anybody ruling Israel must be a Jew. And therefore, right away, it's heretical for Pilate even to be there. We have, first of all, the episode of the Golden Roman Standards. I should say, of the Roman Standards. Pilate, early in his career, was changing the cohorts, and one of them, the Jerusalem cohort, the New Jerusalem cohort, was privileged to fly not only their regimental colors, but also medallions dangling from the flags with the image of Tiberius Caesar on them. Well, this is a violation of the true second commandment. You shall not make any images or likeness of anything in heaven, above, earth, beneath, waters below the earth. You shall not bow down and worship them. Idolatry is the main thrust of that commandment, of course. Well, and so the rioted, they sent a delegation to Caesarea, rioted for 5 days in a row until Pilate finally threatens him with death. They bared their necks, wanted to be executed. They called his bluff, and so Pilate had to back down. And he, not completely, he did not ask the cohort to change its regimental insignia, but he then restationed his cohorts and brought a new cohort into Jerusalem. Now, a second time, this guy couldn't win for losing. He's trying to increase Jerusalem's water supply. Good thing for the city. And he had cooperation from Caiaphas and the priestly authorities to do this. But nobody told the people that some of the funds were being supplied not only by the Romans, but by the temple treasury, the korban, which, of course, is permitted under Jewish law. But suddenly the people who had praised Rome now feel cheated, and there was a big riot, and Pilate told his men, use only billy clubs, don't go to swords, but they did anyway. They got so ticked off at how the governor was being maltreated that it came to bloodshed anyway, which may be, by the way, the episode behind the disciples asking Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate shed. I think that's the episode from secular history. Then we have, of course, the episode of the golden Roman shields. Now, this one is reported by Philo of Alexandria, but this one's terribly important because it happens just about a year before Good Friday. Pilate is in Jerusalem once again at the Passover. This is a time in which he had to appear kind of to keep a lid on the popular pressure. And, of course, Herod Antipas was in town, too, with his brothers of the Herodian dynasty as well. And Pilate hung over the wall, over his desk, two golden shields. These were not encrusted with any images. Pilate had his hands burned on that one. All they were pledges of allegiance to the Emperor Tiberius. At the rim, it said, dedicated to Tiberius Caesar, given by Pontius Pilate. This was the wording around the rim. It should not have been offensive to the Jews. And yet Pilate got a delegation early the next morning from Herod Antipas and his three brothers. And they had this ridiculous conversation, Herod saying, Pilate, take down those shields, they're offensive. And Pilate stood his ground and said, gentlemen, there's no images on these shields. Why do you find them offensive? Well, basically, Pilate knew what Herod was trying to do to him. You got to remember the politics in those days. Herod Antipas, once again, the most successful son of Herod the Great, the guy who killed John the Baptist, was lusting for Pilate's job. He already was in charge of Galilee and Perea, the area beyond the Jordan. And so he figures out if he can show to Rome that Pilate is a political cripple, well, then his resume is already in Tiberius's files. And the great Augustus himself had said, if one of the sons of Herod the Great proves worthy, then he can become king again. So, obviously, you have Herod Antipas wanting to become king. That's why he is always tattling on Pilate every time Pilate makes a miscue. And here now is going to be the third strike, he thinks. Because Pilate now is between a rock and a hard place. If he takes down those two pledges of allegiance, off goes a letter to Rome. Dear Tiberius, guess what your governor just did? he removed his Pledge of Allegiance. Wonder what this means. Or Pilate stands his ground, doesn't take the shields down. Letter number two, an alternate letter goes off to Rome. Dear Tiberius, once again, your governor proves he doesn't know how to govern Jews, and so on into the night, yada, yada, yada. And so Pilate really was very much, again, between a rock and a hard place, and he made the right decision. He says, gentlemen, there is nothing offensive to any of your people here. Thank you for the visit. Good day. Shows him the door. And behind his back, they send a letter to Rome, number two. Tiberius at this time, the emperor, is not in Rome. He's in the island of Capri. He's not really minding the store. And instead of hearing Pilate's side of it, he sends a very threatening letter to Pilate. Pilate, take down those blankety-blank shields, whatever they are. Don't antagonize the Jewish people in any manner, affecting their religious beliefs, or you will have outlived your usefulness in Palestine. Now, Pilate got this letter about 5 or 6 months before Good Friday. It does explain why, despite every effort Pilate is making, when push comes to shove, he cannot cross the people one more time. This shows the pressure he was under.
We'll take a break. When we come back on this Monday, Thursday, April the 5th, we'll continue our conversation on Pontius Pilate with Dr. Paul Meyer. He's Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, and he's author of several books, including Pontius Pilate, a biographical novel. We've got Pontius Pilate appearing in this brief New Testament window, and he sounds like a man who's kind of been painted into, or maybe in some sense painted himself into, a corner. So what happens with Pontius Pilate next? Dr. Paul Meyer will answer that question when we come back.
Pastor Todd, I downloaded your Issues, Etc. app for my Android phone, and I listen to it while I'm on the treadmill.
You can listen to Issues, Etc. live or on demand with the new Issues, Etc. Android or iPhone app. You can download these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. in the palm of your hand. Download an app today.
My new Adam really enjoys the app while I'm on the treadmill.
If Issues Etc. refuses to scratch your itchy ears and scratches your old scabs instead, and you love them for it, then Redeemer Lutheran Church is the church in Fort Wayne for you. The only real difference between Issues Etc. and Redeemer is that Todd and Jeff only talk about Jesus. We talk about Jesus, but we also put him into people's mouths. We drive off demons with water. We are the church. And yes, we serve Jell-O in the basement.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Thanks for supporting the worldwide outreach of Issues, Etc. through the charitable grant program Thrive and Choice. We received more than $15,000 last year through Thrive and Choice. Our goal this year is to raise more than $20,000 through Thrive and Choice. For more information on how you can designate funds to Lutheran Public Radio, look for the Thrivent logo under the donate page at issuesetc.org. Please support Issues Etc. in 2012 with Thrivent Choice.
Coming this Easter Sunday, sacred music for the Easter season. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Lutheran Public Radio, sacred music for the world, coming Easter Sunday at LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Folks, 3 days from today on Easter Sunday, you can listen to some great sacred music for the Easter season. at LutheranPublicRadio.org, at Sacred Music for the World. And all through the Easter season, we'll have some Easter music, the music of the church for you at LutheranPublicRadio.org. That's how you listen, LutheranPublicRadio.org. We're talking about Pontius Pilate. Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest. Dr. Meyer, it sounds like by the time we meet Pontius Pilate in the New Testament, he's got political enemies nearby. He's on strike one or two with Rome, and he's a little afraid of the situation that the people he governs have put him in. Is that a good assessment?
I really think it is. And, you know, I'm not trying to make any hero of Pilate. What I'm trying to say is, boy, this certainly does explain why he's walking on eggshells on Good Friday. What I can't stand are so many liberal theologians today who simply shoot from the hip and make statements like Rosemary Radford Ruther does, the professor of New Testament at Garrett Theological Seminary. She said, the portrait of Pilate deigning to debate with the crowd, as the Gospels have it, is ludicrous. If Pilate were convinced of Jesus' innocence, as the Gospels claim, he would have surrounded him with an honor guard and marched him back to Nazareth. Well, now, you know, you hear this kind of misinterpretation absolutely makes me hit the ceiling. She hasn't done her homework. She hasn't read Josephus or Philo. She doesn't know the background of why Pilate is so defensive on Good Friday. You see now from the evidence, he couldn't possibly have done that. He'd have been shipped out. And so it's either Jesus or himself. And surprise, surprise, he chose to have Jesus crucified rather than giving up his job. I'm not trying to say he's a hero. He's not. But I am trying to say his portrait in the New Testament is absolutely explainable against the background of the surrounding evidence.
Why is he there? You mentioned this briefly a moment ago, but why is he there, a kind of command performance during the feast, this would be the Passover, in Jerusalem, bringing him into contact with Jesus?
Well, every Passover, of course, the Jews got together and a crowd would grow, and this was a chance for revolution. Do you notice how all the uprisings in the Arab Spring today take place right after Friday after worship? Get it? See, they're all together now, then they can be united, and now they can begin some kind of their own version of a messianic movement. Same thing happening here 2,000 years ago. When you get all these Jews coming, all the proselytes coming in from the various areas that are mentioned in Acts chapter 2 in connection with the first Christian Pentecost, they all get together. Hey, and now they have some cheerleaders come along, some zealots, and they can burst out to rioting. This is why Pilate felt that he had to personally be on hand every Passover to keep the lid on any such rioting that would break out. That's why he's there.
Where would he have been in other times?
The rest of the year, of course, he would hang his hat up in Caesarea. This was the Roman capital of Palestine. It was a lovely place to be. It was kind of the Miami Beach of those days. It had a beautiful harbor overlooking the Mediterranean to the west. It had been built in 12 years by Herod the Great. Had a wonderful subterranean plumbing system whereby the high tides of the Mediterranean would come in under the underground aqueducts and take all the human waste and whatever else away out in the Mediterranean and clean it all up. And so it was a lovely place to be, a nice jumping off point if you want to vacation up in Antioch in Syria or sail down to Egypt. So, you know, worse things that could happen to you rather than being a Roman governor. Too many of our biblical novelists have pictured the role of a Roman governor in Palestine like, you know, a person in charge of Alcatraz. Wrong.
So does that connect him to the so-called Pilate Stone that was discovered in the very early 60s?
Oh, you bet. You bet. See, that was discovered in the city of Caesarea. By the way, it's the very same Caesarea where Paul was in prison for 2 years, you recall, later on. And the Pontius Pilate Stone does bear his name, obviously. An Italian archaeological expedition digging in 1971 came across this 2-by-3-foot stone with 2-inch Latin lettering. To the people of Caesarea, Pontius Pilate, the prefect of Judea, has presented the Tiberium building in honor of the Emperor Tiberius. This is very important. Todd, because you know about Bruno Bauer in the last century. Well, I'm talking about the late 1800s. A German higher critic who made shipwreck of his faith claimed that Jesus of Nazareth was not only not Son of God, that's a laugh, but he wasn't even a human being. He never lived. And by the way, we're having more and more mythicists, as they're calling, coming out of the woodwork now. You can see them on the computer blogs claiming that Jesus never even lived historically. And now anybody who claims this is simply flaunting his ignorance. Just remember that. I mean, so this kind of claim was made already in the 1870s or so. And therefore, anybody who dialogued with Jesus, as the New Testament has it, immediately, of course, became a myth, just like somebody talking to Zeus in ancient Greek mythology. They all become mythical. So Brouwer was saying that Pontius Pilate was a myth. But even his colleague said, yeah, aber, wait a minute, Pontius Pilate is mentioned. Several different other ancient sources, including Tacitus. You know what Bauer's answer was? Yeah, those are interpolations. Somebody wrote Pilate's name in there to make the Gospels look good. Well, too bad old Bruno wasn't around in 1971 when the Italian archaeological expedition discovered this 2x3-foot stone. There is hard evidence that, yes, there was a Pontius Pilate.
What did it mean to be governor in the Roman world, a governor, and a governor of this province, Judea?
Okay, you had to have Rome's principal officer there to make sure that this particular province would stay in the empire and not to ride off half-cocked somewhere else. So you're going to have a Roman establishment there militarily. And so the governor there is the last court of appeal for non-citizens in terms of the judiciary. He's also in charge of the military establishment there, and also is the chief political force. So you have all three of the main offices in government located in this one man. The governors, the Roman governors, of course, were taking the place of the original Herodian king, Herod the Great. He was, of course, nothing more or less than a Roman governor. The Romans sometimes saved a little money and a little bit established the peace by using one of the natives who was known to be faithful to Rome and gave him the title king if they wanted it. What did the Romans care? He was effectively the Roman governor of Judea, sending in the tribute where necessary and so on. So they're called either client kings, as Herod the Great was, or until the reign of Claudius, all the Roman governors were called prefects, as the Pontius Pilate stone has it. It was only from Claudius' time on the Roman governors were called procurators. And so many historians make that mistake to the present day, yet they always say that Pilate was the procurator of Judea. Well, they get that from Josephus, who also made a mistake. And it shows you how accurate the Bible is in calling Pilate hegemon, not procurator, which is a good equivalent for the Latin prefect.
You talked about the relationship between Pilate and Herod.
Antipas.
Yeah, was it a genuine political rivalry that Rome kind of permitted in that area?
Oh, yeah. Rome loves that. You see, Rome loves divided authority. Rome doesn't want any particular king getting too big for his own britches. For example, Herod's grandson, Herod Agrippa I, remember the guy who killed James, son of Zebedee, and put Peter in prison? That Herod Agrippa I was getting pretty high and mighty. He was starting to convoke conferences without Rome's permission. And really, it was only his death that intervened, else Claudius would have shipped his old friend off the throne, believe me. So Rome didn't mind this divided authority.
We're told by one of the gospel writers that, with only about 30 seconds here, that Pilate and Herod became friends after the trial of Jesus. What does that say to you?
Now you see how beautifully the non-biblical evidence plays in. What Pilate did in trying to get rid of this case was to send Jesus to the court of Herod Antipas, who was in Rome that day. It was in Jerusalem that day. And therefore, Pilate kills about five birds with one stone here. He doesn't have to knowingly condemn an innocent man. Maybe if he throws a couple of box seats, you might say, to the David Copperfield show that Jesus puts on, that's according to Herod Antipas, then maybe they'll be friends, and he'll stop bellyaching to Rome, see? And this is exactly how beautifully the non-biblical evidence plays in. You can see the secular evidence blending in with the biblical evidence without any framing of the pictures. They just bleed into each other beautifully. The Bible doesn't tell us why they were hostile with one another, but the episode of the Golden Roman Shields does.
When we come back, well, once the New Testament is done with Pontius Pilate, do we know anything about his life subsequent to those all-important events? Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Dr. Arthur Just about the Passion of the Christ according to Luke's Gospel. That's his area of expertise. And also tomorrow, we'll discuss the hymn, O Sacred Head Now Wounded, with Pastor Will Whedon. In the meantime, Pontius Pilate is our subject on this Thursday afternoon. Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest. Stay tuned.
Noted author and history professor Dr. Paul Meyer on the uniqueness of Issues Etc.
I'm delighted not only to listen to Issues Etc., but also to have the privilege of being on the program from time to time. Issues is never afraid to take a stand on the thorny, vexing issues that clutter our daily horizons. And it does so in the name of a solidly based Christianity that doesn't flirt with fads or fantasies. Whereas some Christian programs sidestep ethical and doctrinal questions in our day, Issues take them head-on in a fearless, responsible, thoughtful manner. Both head and heart are involved when Issues applies Holy Scripture.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift today. Donate online at issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
Is Christianity merely one limited, half-true perspective on God? Find out in an article I've written for the latest Issues Etc. journal. It's titled, The Blind Men and the Elephant, and we'll send it to you for free. Just send an email to journal@issuesetc.org. You can also read about Pastor Christian Teve's journey from the agnosticism of a committed Darwinist to faith in Jesus Christ. The online Issues Etc. journal, journal@issuesetc.org.
If any former evangelicals are hearing me speak right now, I want to assure you, you don't have to be a homeless Christian. If you would go to issuesetc.org, look on their website, you'll find a list of churches. Find one close to you and attend that church. There, you can receive the true gospel, you don't have to be a homeless Christian, and they will not call you a backslider.
To find a church near you, go to issuesetc.org and click Find a Church.
Casting Christ's net on the internet. You're listening to Issues Etc.
One judge questions viability arguments.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony list, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
When Amy Hamilton's unborn baby died, she sued her doctors for wrongful death. Amy believed they had not given her baby the care he needed. The lower court ruled that since her baby was not yet viable outside the womb, her doctors could not be sued. But now the Alabama Supreme Court has ruled differently. Judge Thomas Parker pointed out that many states have enacted fetal homicide laws that protect children from conception. He declared that the viability standard established by Roe v. Wade is not relevant outside abortion law and did not apply to Ms. Hamilton's case.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes. Dedicated customer service and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
When you need a friend, you have a friend in Jesus Christ, the Good Shepherd, and friends among His people at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, Arnold, Missouri. At Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, we offer Christ-centered word and sacrament ministry, inspirational liturgical worship services, and faithful preaching and teaching. Sunday worship services are at 9 a.m. Sunday school and Bible class are at 10:30. We also have an excellent Christian preschool. We invite you to join us. Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, 2211 Tenbrook Road, Arnold, Missouri, 636-296-1292.
On this Monday, Thursday, we're talking with Dr. Paul Meyer about Pontius Pilate as we meet him in the New Testament and in secular history as well. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Dr. Meyer, kind of picking up after the New Testament, when the New Testament is done with Pontius Pilate, do we know anything of his life and his activities subsequent to those all-important events?
Sure we do. 3 years later, Pilate himself is shipped out to Rome to answer for a riot that took place on the main north-south highway in Palestine in Samaria. The Samaritans got together and organized a big religious rally on top of Mount Gerizim, the Mount of Blessing. And Pilate is there in a moment and realizes what can happen when crowds get together. And so he has kind of a weapons check-in service at the base of the mountain. And he tells the Samaritan pilgrims, look, you get your weapons back. Don't come armed. We're not going to allow you to be armed in a mass gathering like this. No, they're going to keep their weapons. And so it came to a police action. There was some bloodshed. So the Samaritans complained to the Roman government. And then Tiberius ordered his man there to bounce Pilate out of office and have him come back to Rome for trial. And Pilate does. He makes a winter trip back to Rome. And then what happened? I think is pretty fascinating, because now the judge who changed history is going to be on trial himself. We don't know what happened, because Josephus says that before Pilate could appear before Tiberius, Tiberius had just died in March of 37 A.D. That's all that the actual factual trail gives us.
So what would you, I mean, in terms of speculation, do you think he went, dodged a bullet and retired in Rome?
I think he did dodge the bullet. Now, you open any biblical dictionary, it'll say that Pilate probably committed suicide. No, that comes from a late, late apocryphal source that he committed suicide. It's kind of a case of the early church trying to say, we're going to get the guy who got our Lord kind of a thing, you know? No, I did a scholarly article on it. Pilate faced nothing negative as a result of his administration, not at all. Yeah, I think he could have defended himself very well before Tiberius if there it had come to trial. Caligula was the next emperor. Boy, he's nothing to write home about, I realize. But his early months, the guy was still sane and a good emperor the first 6 months. And Pilate's case would have taken place before Caligula at that point. But Caligula threw all the remaining cases from Tiberius' administration immediately out of court. So Pilate wouldn't even appear before Caligula.
It sounds like the picture that we need to keep in mind politically when it comes to Rome's place in the New Testament, especially as it manifests itself in the person of Pontius Pilate, is they were very pragmatic. It was a lot about keeping the peace, wasn't it?
You bet. Absolutely. You know, Rome gets something of a bad rap, I think, in most biblical novels, with, of course, the exception of my book and Pontius Pilate. in any case, I don't make a hero of him, but I show how beautifully the New Testament conforms to everything we know about the political, economic, social situation at the time. All the rules of Roman jurisprudence are faithfully followed by the scriptures, no question about it. But again, you know, we have the Romans as a horrendous group who burn the villages down, who kidnap people until they pay ransom, who are brutalized. No, no. I would much rather, April 15th is coming up, I would much rather pay Roman provincial tax as a Jew than American income tax, I'll tell you that. tremendous difference. And so, really, the Romans got nasty only when the Christian persecutions came along. Before this, generally, Tiberius, for example, was very concerned that the overseas governors do a good job, and he encouraged the local councils to appeal to Rome if there's any maladministration. And so he fired several governors. So Rome is trying to do a good job. But again, under some of the worst emperors later on, like Caligula and Nero, we have the government deteriorating, no question about it.
I want to get to the details of the trial that you've mentioned several times here in just a minute. But first, this is just a matter of personal curiosity. One of the gospel writers, it's a strange little account during the trial of Jesus, records that Pilate's wife counsels him in the midst of the trial to have nothing to do with Jesus because, as she says, I've suffered much on account of him in a dream. What would that have – I don't know what the dream was, obviously, and no one could. But what would that have meant to a Roman governor to hear his wife say, I dreamt about this guy last night. It was terrible. Stay away from him.
Today, of course, a judge would say, wifely dear, don't interfere. So what? We all have bad dreams. But 2,000 years ago, don't forget Julius Caesar's wife, the night before his assassination, she dreams of Caesar's torn and bloodied toga and tells Caesar not to go downtown that day. He should have listened to his wife. No, dreams are very serious to the Romans. So they were regarded as something, occasionally as divine oracles. This was, hey, in the Old Testament, we have the same thing, don't we? God came to so-and-so in a dream. And so the Romans had the same idea. The gods were trying to get through to them. And so they took these dreams rather seriously, more seriously than we would today. You notice in the New Testament, when the note from Pilate's wife comes along, that Pilate's a little spooked out, and this is where he conducts the inner hearing, not before the crowd, but as Jesus come inside his praetorium. And then he asks him, where have you come from? And that doesn't mean Capernaum. That means, is there something more here than meets the eye? It's really a metaphysical question.
So to the trial, you've provided us a lot of detail. Why does Pilate agree to hear this, what he regards as an essentially religious matter at all? Why does he condescend to listen to their case?
He doesn't want to at first. You know, he says, take us out of here. It's not my case. Go condemn him yourselves, you know, if you want to. But, of course, right there he knew that they could not do that in a capital case anymore. Because just 3 years earlier, Pilate, probably under pressure from an anti-Semitic patron of his in Rome, had withdrawn from the Jews the right of capital punishment. So now the roosters came home to roost. And then now he's trying to pay for that, unfortunately, by now he's got to conduct the capital case. And because the Romans now had the law of the sword, the jus gladii, was now in their position, the Jews could no longer do their own stoning to death for blasphemy. Well, they could, when Pilate's back up in Caesarea for most of the year, that's how Stephen, the first Christian martyr, got stoned to death. But at this point, he's in Jerusalem for the Passover, so is Jesus, and now we have the Jews saying, you know, the trump card they drop in front of Pilate is, we have a law by, let's see, whoever makes himself a king speaks treason against Caesar. And that was a marvelously loaded bit of blackmail saying, you know, you release this man, we'll send another letter to Rome. No, maybe we'll send a delegation this time. We'll hang you out to dry, Pilate, on two bases. One, harboring a traitor who claims to be king of the Jews, and we have no king but Caesar. And secondly, you have violated Tiberius's letter that you just got 6 months ago in the case of the golden Roman shields. And if Tiberius decided in our favor in something as basically insignificant as a couple of shields, just imagine how much more he will decide in our favor in the case of someone who makes himself a god, son of God, and therefore ruins our monotheism.
So
you, Pilate, will no longer be friend of Caesar, meaning you're going to lose your membership in the club in Rome called the Amici Caesaris. That's the Friends of Caesar Club. This was available only to high senators and governors overseas. To be a member of that club, you got a golden ring in your finger with an emperor of Tiberius' signet on it. And you never lost membership in that club except for high treason. I did some research on ex-Friends of Caesar. There were not many. And usually the result was compulsory exile or suicide. So that's what turned the trial. At that point, they had boldly laid out their blackmail. Pilate, at that point, saw it's Jesus or himself. And surprise, surprise, he opts for number one.
So they're essentially saying to him, and you referenced this a moment ago, we have a law, and by that law he must die. They're saying, look, Pilate, this is a capital case. You're the only one who can carry out a capital execution, and if you don't do it, guess what? The things that we know about this guy, that he's claimed about himself, he makes himself a rival to Caesar. You want to stay on Caesar's good side, and we already know that you've got two strikes against you, so do what we say.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And again, for the benefit of your hearers, remember that every time we use the term Caesar, that's now generic for the Roman emperor, whoever he may be. Julius Caesar was the first. He gives the name to all the others. But whenever they, for instance, later on when Paul appeals to Caesar, he's not appealing to Julius Caesar. He's appealing to Nero.
When we come back, Dr. Meyer mentioned earlier that in the trial, Pilate does not want to convict Jesus. He does not want to put Jesus to death. He tries every trick in the book. He tries a change of venue. And then he also tries a Passover amnesty. Wants to let Jesus go, but the people won't have it. We'll talk about that after this break.
Hi, this is Jonathan Collin from France.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
First, I would like to say thank you very much for your program. It very much ministers to those of us who are outside the comforts and the luxuries of having a confessional Lutheran congregation nearby. Thank you very much for this great resource.
Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. IssuesETC.org.
Have you heard of the CLCC? In Hosea 4, we see, my people are destroyed by lack of knowledge. The Confessional Lutherans for Christ's Commission can help educate Lutherans on being Lutheran. We treasure our Lutheran beliefs and think that all Lutherans would if they learn what we believe, teach, and confess. So visit our website, www.theclcc.org. Check out what we have to offer. Get on our mailing list, or better yet, join us. And maybe encourage your pastor to hold a seminar in your area. Just go to theclcc.org.
Continuing education for the Confessional Lutheran. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. St. John Lutheran, Springfield, Pennsylvania. Zion Lutheran, Detroit, Michigan. St. Paul's Lutheran, Long Beach, California. All Saints Lutheran, Charlotte, North Carolina. Redeemer Lutheran, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Shepherd of the Lake Lutheran, Garrison, Minnesota. Emmanuel Lutheran, Kansas City, Missouri. And Holy Cross Lutheran, St. Genevieve, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Our guest in this hour, Dr. Paul Meyer, has lent some of his credibility, considerable as it is, by writing a foreword for our Issues Etc. book of the month for April called The Church from Age to Age. Now, this book is a little different than other church histories because it goes from the time of the apostles up to the present. It doesn't stop at the 16th century Reformation or sometime in the last century. It tries to follow the history all the way up till now. It's called The Church from Age to Age from Concordia Publishing House. Browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and order this new church history called The Church from Age to Age, a history. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April. Dr. Meyer, in the trial, you said before that Pilate tries every trick in the book to get Jesus off. You mentioned before the change of venue, sending him off to Herod. And then there's this Passover amnesty. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you recall in the New Testament it says that Pilate says, you have a custom by which I release whatever person you want from prison once a year at the Passover as a favor to you. And he chose, Al Capone, John Dillinger, public enemy number one, as a nice counterfoil to Jesus. Surely the crowd would choose Jesus to be released rather than this public enemy number one. Well, what do you know? The surprise comes from the crowd. No, the priest said, have him choose Barabbas instead. Now, this Passover amnesty deal is very unusual. It is the very only item in the Good Friday trial in which Jesus stands before Pontius Pilate that I can't document with a parallel elsewhere in Roman jurisprudence. This doesn't mean that it didn't happen, obviously. All I'm saying is that's how good we can document the facts on Good Friday. Every last step in the trial has parallels in Roman law except for this one.
What does it mean that he washes his hands? Is that a kind of a semi-official judicial jurisprudential kind of statement that he's making?
I'd say more or less it's a good use of the power of illustration. The idea to wash your hands of something, that's a very ancient expression. Of course, not in English, but in various other languages. This shows that you are distancing yourself from the process at hand. It's almost an echo of what Pilate tells the crowd when he says, oh, you take him and judge him yourself, you know, and so forth. I want nothing to do with this, he says early on in the trial. And at the end of the trial, he says, look, you guys have pressed me to the wall. Yeah, evidently I got to decide this way, but look, I want no part of it. Of course, that doesn't mean he's exculpated, that is, relieved of the onus for having done this. But what I'm trying to say is this is, again, a physical demonstration. You don't have many parallels that I can check on that as to whether other Roman judges washed their hands. I'll have to check on that though with a little more research.
In that private conversation with Jesus, probably Pilate's most famous, well, he has two famous phrases, behold the man, and then the one that I wanted to ask your thoughts on, and that is, what is truth? When Jesus proposes that he has come as a bearer of the truth, Pilate asks that question. With a view toward the way of ancient Romans thinking, what do you think Pilate was saying there?
Well, I think it's a tremendously interesting statement because, listen, it applied not only contemporarily in the first century, but does it ever apply today? You know, what is truth today in our post-Christian generation, you know, in our deconstructionist era? That question's being asked again and again, kind of sneered at. Skeptical question. Hey, what's true for me is true for me, and therefore it's true. Who cares? My truth is more important than your truth. The relativism that we have today, which is, you know all about that, clearly. I'm sure you've had other philosophers on who've talked about our deconstructionist era. our post-modern era, as it's called. And so yeah, I think you have an example of that here 2,000 years ago. You know, some things don't change in the way people think and in their skepticism.
Is he also in part commenting on the corner into which he himself, Pilate, has found himself painted at that particular moment? That it doesn't really matter what the truth is, Jesus. This is going
to
happen.
Yeah, I think he's probably trying to use it maybe as something that will solve his own conscience, trying to get out of there. By the way, Todd, I want to mention something that Christians ought to know about, because remember Mel Gibson, back when he had a reputation, you know, The Passion of the Christ and so forth, everybody was dissing Mel Gibson for daring to follow the biblical roadmap. Do you realize we have a precise parallel to the Good Friday trial, which happened 29 years later, and nobody seems to know about this one because nobody reads Josephus anymore? Well, Josephus carefully tells us what happened to the half-brother of Jesus of Nazareth. His name was James, as you well know. James the Just of Jerusalem. Josephus carefully tells us that in 62 AD, that'd be 29 years after Good Friday, James was put on trial. He's the first bishop of the church. Clearly, Acts 15 tells us that. So does Josephus, first bishop of the church. He put on trial for his Christianity, just like his half-brother Jesus was 29 years earlier. Look at the parallels. Jesus condemned by the Sanhedrin in 62, condemned by the Sanhedrin against some of the same people. Some had died, of course, in the meantime. The high priest back in 33 was Joseph Caiaphas. The high priest in 62 was Caiaphas's brother-in-law, Ananus, one of the five sons of Annas. They, both cases, they're condemned for their Christianity. The governor back in 33 is Pontius Pilate, reluctant to condemn Jesus, as all our gospel sources tell us. The governor in 62 AD was named Albinus. He hadn't arrived yet at his post, but word came to him that James had been stoned to death by the Sanhedrin. And he was so ticked off that this had happened that he arranged to have the high priest, Ananus, kicked out of office for malfeasance of justice. Now, there you have an Albinus, the second time a Roman governor is trying to do the right thing as Pilate did. You got a perfect parallel to Good Friday, but more. Here in 62, you have the record of a Jew who never converted to Christianity. If he wanted to, could have been hostile to Christianity, but nevertheless gives us this tremendously valuable information showing it really happened. This wasn't written by another Christian writer making the Gospels look good. Do you see my point? How can people dare to try to tear apart the Good Friday episode when you have a perfect recapitulation of it 29 years later? I mean, this is one of the best documented trials in history. We not only have Joseph Caiaphas showing up in all four Gospels, Jewish rabbinic traditions, and Josephus, we have his bones. How come nobody hears about this? The bones of the first biblical personality ever discovered came to light in November of 1990, publicly announced in 1992, but nobody was listening. I can be talking to a pastoral conference of 300, and I will ask, does anybody know whose biblical bones have been discovered? And about 1% of the group will know it's Joseph Caiaphas. So my point is this. Here's hard evidence for what happened on Good Friday. And look at the judge named in all four Gospels. Named in Josephus, named by Cornelius Tacitus. His name is on the cornerstone. I mean, what more do people need in terms of guaranteeing that the Good Friday trial is probably the best documented such process in all of ancient history?
Dr. Paul Meyer is Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo.
He's author of several books, including Pontius Pilate, a biographical novel. You can purchase Pontius Pilate at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Meyer, thank you very much for being our guest.
Enjoy being with you again, Todd. Blessings.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., that's Good Friday, we'll study the hymn O Sacred Head Now Wounded with Pastor Will Whedon, and we'll also discuss the Passion of Christ according to Luke's Gospel. Dr. Arthur Just will be our guest. Folks, here's a way that you can support Christ-centered, cross-focused talk radio. It's called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. That's our monthly or annual donor program. You can find out the benefits of becoming an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron by calling Craig at 618-223-8385. The number again, 618-223-8385. Or check out the photo of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses at our homepage, issuesetc.org, the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. Now, Pilate is the man who ultimately condemns Jesus to death, even if by simply washing his hands of the entire situation. He's the man who does this. But make no mistake about it. Jesus goes to his crucifixion condemned in a higher court, far higher than Pilate had, far higher than even Caesar could have had. Jesus goes to the cross, to his crucifixion, to his death, condemned in the highest court of them all. And he is innocent. There's no two ways about that. He's as innocent as you get. No sin in him, and yet condemned in the divine court of his Father to die, not for his sins, but for mine and for yours, so that we might be completely forgiven, completely exonerated. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.